Hey Larry, how are you tonight?
I'm just swell, Andy. Do they still use that term anymore, swell? I think I heard that 20 years ago.
There was an episode of the I Love Lucy show where they were going to bring in a speech tutor, therapist, whatever, to teach little Ricky how to talk properly, and Lucy did not do well. She was using all the words that were not appropriate, and I think the instructor eventually just like said, FYP, I quit, and walked out. Because, yeah, she said, well, I'm doing just swell. And the teacher just, you could just see her neck starting to twitch and eyes rolling. And yeah, she just said, I can't work with you people.
Well, it's been at least 20 years since I've heard that, or maybe more, so.
There was another term in the show, too, and I don't remember offhand what it was. So one of you listeners that's older than probably at least 40 or are watching a lot of I Love Lucy reruns on Netflix or wherever you can pick them up, let me know what the other word was.
Will do.
Please consider making us a part of your podcast diet. All right. Here's the thing about podcasts. I've been talking to somebody about podcasts. There are more people that go to the website that listen to the podcast than that have a podcast app. And we've talked about this a bunch of times. I can't figure out why you wouldn't just want your phone to just pick the thing up and then you have it with you. I know there's somebody in Tennessee. He's going to write back to me and go, well, I want to listen to it this way or that way. You can get around all of that, but I do not know why you would want to wait for an email message to show up on your in your email box, why you would want to just constantly refresh and go back to the website. This thing is published at 11 o'clock on Monday nights, unless something crazy happens. Just let your podcast app pick it up. You can use Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher. There's a bazillion podcast apps. Subscribe to the podcast, and it will just show up on your phone, and you can listen to it while you're doing chores or out in the yard or going to work or while you're going to sleep. Because I know that listening to Larry while you are going to sleep, you will sleep very peacefully at night.
Well, I can tell you the answer to why people do it that way. We do things the way we do them because that's the way we've always done them. How many times have you worked at a job when you ask someone why, and it's been done that way so long, no one can tell you why they're doing it. They just say, this is the way we've always done it. This is the way we do it. Nobody can tell you why they do it. The people are comfortable waiting for the email to come in, or going to the website, or doing their that this is the that's the way they've always done it, and it works for them. That's why they keep doing it that way.
Absolutely. And so on that, if you want to be notified by email directly from us, feel free. There's a sign up form on the website. And as soon as the episode is released, you'll get an email message and you can go right to the website and listen to it there. That would be grand. Also, the show is supported by our patrons, and we have some patrons that have been supporting us for a very long time. I reach out to you individually and thank you. I did have a little mishap and I said something to everybody that was only supposed to go to one person. My apologies. But you guys rock. And if you'd like your own exclusive Registry Matters Blue Ball, please consider heading over to patreon.com/registrymatters and donate just $1 a month. I will love you forever, and you will receive a blue ball, an exclusive Registry Matters blue ball in the mail.
And then they will have blue balls in the
Well, no, that would
community.
only be if they get a second one, then they would have blue balls.
But there are blue balls in the community.
There are blue balls out there. There's a pretty prolific number of them out there.
All righty. I'm glad to hear that we're getting
Yes.
our blue balls out.
Do you want to tell them what network this is, Larry?
This is the FYP network.
Right, this first article comes from WCPO. Springfield Township man claims Ohio sex offender parole law won't allow visits with his son. This is, so the guy gets convicted of, it was a sex crime with an adult, with at least an 18-year-old. It was a student.
Yes, that was a student, yes.
So I guess, the inverted situation of that case, what was it in Connecticut up in New England, the female teacher and the male student, I guess something roughly similar. And
It's up to switch the gender. That's the
yeah.
difference.
And so he's on the registry. He's now unemployed. He's having a hard time actually staying married. His wife is saying that the stress of their situation, she can't split the time of staying with the son versus the dad, and it's too much. And he can't. What's funny to me is while he was in prison, I think he served 3 years, he could write letters and talk to his kid on the phone. And at visitation, he could hug them when they arrived. You know, those, you know, minor kind of contact things at visitation. Now he can't have any contact with his kid. He's the biological father, and his crime was with a opposite sex of his son, obviously. And the victim was an adult for practical purposes.
I read this article, and I just read it prior to coming on to do the podcast. And I'm just, I have lack of words, which is unusual for me, but I'm at a loss for words to explain this. The only way I can explain this is that in Ohio, in this particular jurisdiction, and we have some Ohio people that could probably explain how they supervise people, but I think it's county to county. Well, where in my state, we have a state division of probation, parole division. But these people have apparently decided as a blanket policy that anyone who has a sexual offense cannot have any contact with minors, and it's with minors, period. Well, the kid is a minor at this point. He's got four more years before he's no longer 14. A minor.
Yep.
So therefore, you know, I ask myself, and I have trouble when I ask myself this, I ask myself, if I were a PO, I would be notoriously pushing back, saying to my supervisor, I'm sorry, we can't do this. I mean, this is unconscionable. I can't do this. We have a lot of people who don't understand how the people in Nazi Germany were able to carry out all the various orders. And there were a lot of things short of putting people in the ovens and the gas chambers that people did that were despicable because that's what they were ordered to do. Removing the jewelry from the people, you name it, whatever they did along the way. And people just simply blindly follow orders. And that's what these people are doing. I would not be able to help myself. I would be saying, no, ma'am, no, sir, I cannot follow this order. I cannot. I'm a parent myself, which I'm not. But if, I imagine that there's a good chance that person is. I can't tell this person that they can't have any contact with their son. What the hell's the matter with you?
Yeah, but first of all, you're a bleeding heart liberal do-gooder. But this is, what was I just going to say? It's like from a strategy standpoint, he's asking for a restraining order. To me, that doesn't sound like the right approach.
That's the correct thing to do. Go ahead.
It is? Okay. All right. So to stop his parole officer from enforcing the law.
Well, it's not the law. It's a policy. Maybe it is a law, but the way I read it, it was a policy that they have in terms of how they supervise people. I don't believe it's in statute. But if it were a policy, and we're putting an if in there, so those listeners, if it's a policy and it's not in statute, that there's discretion in terms of modifying the policy, and there's discretion in terms of how rigorously you enforce the policy. And I would push back in many times in employment situations where I told people, no, we can't do that. No, that we cannot do that. What the hell's wrong with you?
Right.
We can't do that. But apparently people just say, yes, sir. And no one pushes back anymore. But this is something that where he's gone to federal court and he's seeking an injunction to prohibit them from enforcing that restriction on him. And I suspect even whether he drew a conservative or liberal judge, I suspect there's a good chance he'll win this based on what I see here. That there's no relationship. This condition has to be reasonably related to him, the underlying offense, and to the unique characteristics of him as an offender. And I can't see any relationship. His victim was not a minor. His
not
victim
related.
Was not inside the home.
Right.
I just don't see that.
Not
this
related
is
in any way. Not a cousin or a, you know, whatever, a niece. Yep.
Now there would be if he had disclosed on his disclosure that he had had prosecuted victims. If he was in that category of people who believe that that the truth sets you free. And he told them all this stuff. They may have information that we don't see in this article here. We'd have to actually look at the complaint that he filed. But if this is all there is to it, this blanket policy is likely to be struck as applied to him.
I can tell you it's in mine. It's in my probation stuff. I had to get an order from the judge to modify my sentence to be able to see my kid.
Mm-hmm. That's where these blanket policies, and that's where someone, rather than going doing it individually, they ought to do a collective action and say this blanket policy cannot stand without any discretion and unique characteristics analysis. This is BS. I know I can't say the other word because this is a family show.
Well, the other part of this is he's listed as a doe, so we don't know who his handlers are. I would be more than happy to call them out by name in this particular case. I do not like what they're doing, and I think they should be called out for their action.
Well, I think we've got enough information to call out the reach to a ministry of the Ohio Department of Rehabilitation. So that doesn't give us much information.
No, we'd have to kind of dig around to know about the Forest Park area, wherever he's from. But anyway, that would be on my agenda of things to do. One question I did have for you, though, is do you have a fundamental right to be with your spouse and your children?
Well, it seems like if you have the fundamental right to marriage,
do you?
It would seem like, yes, we've got court decisions that says you can marry whoever you want to. You may not be able to sponsor them for admission into the United States if they're not a citizen, but you can marry them. I would think that your children are, I mean, I can't cite to the case, but I would think your children are a basic right unless there's some extraordinary circumstances where the state has to take custody of the children.
So the reason why I'm asking this is because, I don't know, I told you this about 2 weeks ago. I'm kind of like formulating this whole theory of if it's not in the Constitution, it doesn't exist. And I don't think that's in the Constitution. Right?
Well, it may not be in the Constitution, but there's interpretive case law out there for the last 240 years. There's no right in the Constitution to an abortion.
Right.
But it's been interpreted as a right to privacy that is in the Constitution.
Yeah, they started citing Fourth Amendment protections, right?
For the right to abortion?
Yeah, well, I mean, it was like search and seizure, your right to privacy, things of that nature. You have a right to, I mean, your privacy, isn't that Fourth Amendment of having government knowing what you're up to?
I believe so.
So, I mean, they listed in there as having a fundamental right to your wife and your kid. And I mean, obviously, if they've done it in Ohio and Georgia, I can only imagine it has been done in other places where they have some sort of blanket, something, statute, law, whatever.
Well, it's all over the country. It's all over the country. We experience it here where people have to go fight to have access to their kids.
It feels but I mean, the other part of that really bugs me is in the prison setting, on the telephone, through letters, you can still have. So you, in a sense, have more freedom while you're locked up than once you're out.
Well, in the article it said that he alleged in the complaint he's not even allowed to have a photograph of his son now.
Yes.
And clearly, prisons do have, they allow a certain limited number of photographs.
Yes.
And it also mentioned email. Some prisons have access to email on a limited basis, but it said he could do email. He had pictures. Now he can't have a picture of his son. This is great stuff.
Yep. Mr. Doe has no history of abusing his son and poses no risk to him. His son will be 18, college aged, by the time his father is allowed to speak with him on the phone, send him a letter, or give him a hug, as he did while in prison.
And they said that he could pay them, the probation people, a fee for them to supervise visits. I love that as well.
Yes. Yeah. And he would have to have, some sort of approved person to supervise it. I'm trying to remember what the word is called of the person that would do it. I can't remember what they call it. But so, yeah, you guys in Ohio, you guys rock. That's pretty awesome.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, it's everywhere.
Yeah, I know. I didn't mean to just call them out and hate on them specifically. They're good people up there, but that's just garbage. And yeah, I know it happens in other places too. Well, let's move on to the next happy and fun article, right?
And this one's delightful. Yes.
Yeah, so this one is from the Green Bay Press Gazette. This one's funny. Brown County Library branches in Denmark, Green Bay, are trapped by conflicting laws and security concerns. So this is what I wanted to ask you. I wanted to set this up a little bit different. So they have their laws there say that the libraries are open to all people. You don't have to give your ID upon entering into the library. All right. That sounds smart because that's where like the community would distribute information. Schools have kind of turned into little mini prisons, sort of kind of, with restricted access and metal detectors and photo ID scanners or in camera facial recognition stuff. But in some communities, you have libraries in the schools. So now where a library is completely open to anybody coming in, you could have a library in a school that is going to, when you walk in there, they're going to search your photo and your name and stuff against the registry, and now they're going to restrict access of you going into the school.
Well, I would clarify that within most schools that I attended back in the day, they had libraries that were open to the school students and faculty. What you're talking about here in Denmark is a town in Wisconsin, apparently, there's this library is a public library that happens to be operating within a high school setting. And that therein lies the problem, because librarians are generally non-political. I mean, they have their own political personal beliefs, but every library person I've met in my decades on earth, I've forgotten how many it is now, but they tend to shy away from political discussions. That they're providing a service of information and knowledge, and they believe the library should be open, and librarians will generally fight for the right for homeless to be in the library as long as they're not disrupting. So they want as few barriers to library services can be, and they're caught in a conundrum, because to get their grants and to get funding from library sources, they have to proclaim that their library is open. But since their library is in a school building, their library isn't open, because everybody is being checked and being often being denied access, because they might be on the registry or whatever things will deny a person access to the school building, which is where they have to be gain access to first before they can go to the library. So they are in a real pickle there about what to do, because they don't want to turn people away, but they don't have the funds. The community doesn't want to spend the money to build a library,
right?
Because there are those who believe libraries are a thing of the past. It's difficult to fund new libraries.
Yeah,
it's even difficult to fund existing libraries, because the cost of periodicals has gone through the roof, mm-hmm. and people say that you don't need periodicals anymore. It's all online, so why do you want to pay for the expensive publications? And the libraries have turned into nothing more than an internet cafe for people who don't have access to internet. So you go in, there'll be 50 computer terminals, and there'll be three books on the shelves, or what they call them, stacks. They don't. I mean, the library you see today is so different than what would have been in my day. But the librarians are trying to preserve access to information, and they don't want to do this.
The libraries of your day, they were filled with stone tablets, right?
Well, I think that we had gotten one step above stone. I think they had the pens that had the feather and the ink. The thing,
a quill. How do you see this one turning out?
It's difficult to predict, because the school's not going to back off for the safety of the children.
If it saves one man.
And the school board's not likely to relent. And the library is probably going to have to capitulate and risk losing their funding. And then they'll have to go back to the community and say, well, we lost our funding because you didn't want to build us a separate building where we could get access. So we lost our grants. And so we're going to have to close our doors or restrict hours, which is what the article said.
You really
it's tragic.
You think that they're going to basically cut off their nose and spite of their face?
Well, I don't think the library will, but I don't think they have any choice. The school is going to control. The school controls the perimeter of who gets in.
I'm saying the community then is going to cut off their nose and spite of their face.
School won't see it. The school won't see it that way. They will see it as protecting and keeping their kids safe. They won't see it that way at all. They'll say, well, we'll just have to have we'll have to take control of this space and have it as a library for the students and faculty, and the other people just won't come in. We're sorry it turned out that way. We're sorry, but we have to worry about the safety of the children. That's what they'll say.
And there are probably incredibly low numbers of cases where someone was abducted from a school
library. I've never
library.
Heard of a case where anything happening in a library.
I can't imagine.
When we were having that debate here, the case was cited, the Albuquerque library case, which is notorious because it went to the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals, and it cost the city millions of dollars once they got out from under that litigation, because they couldn't satisfy themselves by losing at the district court level. They had to appeal to the 10th Circuit. So they spent a whole bunch of money. But the court said the libraries have to be accessible. And the people up in Wisconsin even mentioned this case. They know that libraries are supposed to be open, but they've got to keep the children safe.
Well, this one comes from law.com, and it's out of New Jersey. And the article is entitled, Supreme Court Sets New Evidentiary Standard in a Child Sex Abuse Case. This one is way above my pay grade, but I think my assessment of it is that kind of like pseudoscience had been allowed to be entered into the court setting, but it's not in the DSM. It's not in the Diagnostic and Statistics Manual for psychiatrists to use. And the elements that they were trying to introduce into the cases were behavior that were reportedly common in victims of child sexual abuse or secrecy, helplessness, entrapment, and accommodation, delayed, conflicted, unconvincing disclosure, and retraction. And there's no evidence to support that there's anything really like true behind those things. I think they said except for one, and that was it delayed, I think? And like there's a delayed response of a child reporting a sexual abuse instance. So the judge says it doesn't apply here, but this is going to be challenging for them to try and use those elements in a case in the future.
Well,
how'd I do?
In the case here, there was enough other evidence,
yeah,
that the delayed reporting did not compromise because there was consistent contemporaneous reporting. Actually, there was a recording, according to the story of one of the assaults, which but the child sexual abuse accommodation syndrome, CSAAS, as courts across the nationwide across the country have bought into this theory that an expert is allowed to come in and testify that based on their expertise, their high level of expertise, that this child is a victim of something because of this. They have such a gift to be able to know what happened, even though there's little evidence to support it. Yeah, kind of like the McMartin preschool, all the hogwash that went into that fiasco back in the 80s or 90s, wherever that was. Well, the courts bought into this. They're basically overturning themselves. They had ruled this type of evidence was admissible in 1993 in State versus JQ, New Jersey Supreme Court is what we're talking about here. So they've had an epiphany themselves, and they've realized over the intervening decades that this has been debunked as junk science. So now this is no longer going to be enough to convict a person because an expert says, this person suffered abuse. There's going to have to be some more evidence other than your expert testimony.
That's good news on our part as far as people just. I mean, this ultimately is being accused and convicted on a bunch of hearsay, essentially.
That right? is, it's even worse than that. But yeah, that's the best description is that an expert gets to come in and opine. And guess these experts get paid. You know, they get paid by the state,
right,
to be an expert witness against you. And it's hopeless to defend yourself because the expert is going to be the believed one. The yeah. court has certified them as an expert. So the jury elevates them up to the jury and says, this person is allowed to give an opinion. A lay witness is not allowed to give an opinion. They're merely allowed to state the facts. But this expert is revered by the jury as being the New Jersey Supreme Court said, nope, not here. And this may start to go around the country where courts actually set their own standards for admissibility. There are a lot of states, particularly the conservative ones, where the legislatures like to set the standards of what's admissible as evidence. In Louisiana, when we had Keegan Alexander on, he kind of went into that. We can go into it again with him. How when the court rules something's not admissible, they just come back and change the rules and say, court, you will admit that. That is not admissible evidence. But in states like mine, where the courts say, to hell with you at the legislature, we decide how the courts run. This might catch on in my state as well, because our court is very independent, as the judiciary is supposed to be, and they thumb their nose at the judiciary trying to tell, I mean, the legislature branch trying to tell them how to run the courts. Now, the legislature gets to say what the laws are and what the penalty ranges are, but they don't get to tell the courts how to conduct and what's admissible and what's not.
Can you expand on that? As an independent branch, they can do whatever they want as far as how their procedures go. Obviously, they're not writing the law, but they can determine yes. what evidence is allowed and not allowed. What else would that cover?
That is correct. In my state, the courts administer themselves. I mean, they don't have their own funding source. They have to go to the legislature for funding. And that's one way the legislature always has the upper hand, because if they don't like the way the courts are administering, they can magically decide that they need fewer dollars. But in terms of the due process, what constitutes due process? Our courts determine what constitutes due process. We don't succumb to the legislature telling us how to query a witness and what is admissible evidence. Now the legislature does determine the statute of limitations.
Right.
They determine whether there is a statute of limitations. The court doesn't get to determine that. They get to determine what degree of felony or if something's a misdemeanor.
Or
whether it's a citation, fine only offense. The legislative branch gets to determine that, but they don't get to run the courts.
Right. Well, and I guess then the judicial branch doesn't get to run the legislative branch either, right?
That is correct.
They can't turn around and say that Mitch McConnell, he's not allowed to make it just a majority vote to get a Supreme Court nominee. They can't step in.
That is correct. That is a Senate rule. The filibuster rule has changed through the years. It used to be like 2/3.
Yeah.
And then it dropped to 60 at some point, and now it's for all practical purposes, it's been abolished.
It's 50 plus whatever you can come up with, even if, you know, John McCain on his deathbed, if he can barely raise his thumb, it counts.
But the court's not in a position to tell the Senate how you should conduct your affairs within the Senate. And that's what some people resent when, example, the IML came down. The way they did it, that was procedurally okay. You may not find it ideal. It may not be the way you would like it to have gone down at the waning hours of a session where they did it on a voice vote, but that's procedurally okay. It's permissible. So,
but this talking about like expert witnesses, which is you brought up, that is kind of similar to the forensics labs. They are associated with the DA's office. They have an incentive to bring evidence that supports what the DA is prosecuting for, where they should be an independent entity, and they're just there to find the truth. And if the DA's office is bringing in expert witnesses to support their case, well, that person's not going to get hired again to be an expert witness if they don't support what the DA is prosecuting.
Well, with the vast law enforcement resources, the state doesn't have to go outside its own resources as often as defense does. I don't know any attorneys that employ a full-time crime lab.
Of course.
But the states and many city police departments do have a full-time crime lab. They have forensic specialists. That's their job, is to collect forensics and analyze it and they theoretically will tell you they're independent. They're just trying to find the truth.
And maybe they work with integrity, but it feels like it's a conflict of interest if they are not their own independent branch.
Well, I was going to say, like the Albuquerque Police Crime Lab, they're trying to help Albuquerque Police close cases. They're not trying to help a defense attorney dismiss a charge.
That's what I'm saying.
So the detective contacts them and asks them what they're looking for. They work hand in hand with the detectives. They don't work hand in hand with the defense.
That sounds like one of those cases where it should be something of a private-public partnership of something like that. I mean, because I don't know.
You just starting to sound like a damn liberal do-gooder.
My bad. Well, I mean, because no one's going to set up a private for-profit crime lab. I can't imagine that exists by far and large. Unless you're O.J. Simpson and you can afford to go hire that kind of crime lab to go do that work. But for Joe Schmo, there should be something lower down on the totem pole that is accessible, that is nonpartisan, but, you know, not biased to one side of the argument or the other.
Well, joking aside, seriously, that is a very, very big issue for defense, because dollars for alternate interpretations of forensics are hard to come by.
Right.
For the defense, if it's a private retained client, the defendant has to come up with the money. So the lawyer's already quoted you a $20,000 fee, mm-hmm. and then he says, "And by the way, to do this case right, I need another $10,000 for experts or mm-hmm. whatever the case may be."
Mm-hmm.
And when you're private retained, there are some opportunities, so you can tap into public resources for experts. There again, those are hard to come by, because the theory goes, if you can retain your counsel, you should be able to retain your experts. And then if you're just straight represented by a public entity to begin with, those dollars are very hard to come by, because it's really hard to convince funders to pump lots of money into expert services for accused. I mean, I challenge anybody who's listening to this podcast, why don't you go to your local neighborhood meeting and stand up and say, we're not spending enough money on representation and expert services for people accused of crimes and come back and call in or send an email to this podcast and tell me what the result was after you spoke those words. Tell me if there was a smashing round of applause or if there was a whole lot of boos. I'd be curious to hear that. The public is not willing to front these resources, and public defender services is often lacking the capacity to have an objective second opinion on the validity of the forensics. It's just the reality of the situation.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that goes to the whole, like, underfunded. If you are in the lower socioeconomic statuses, the whole bond side of it, then getting proper representation, you know, I mean, it just, it escalates and it becomes a larger exponential problem through that whole chain.
And people that believe in the virtues that capitalism can solve any problem, this is a problem that capitalism has not been able to solve. There's no incentive for capitalists to come forward with money to provide indigent representation. I just can't see an angle that you can work for. So capitalism has its limitations, and this is one of those: providing indigent defense, or even providing indigent civil representation, legal services, is difficult for the capitalist system. Although you will find donations to civil, there are foundations that there are some funding for civil. But when you're accused with a crime, there's not a whole lot of sympathy for you. You shouldn't have done it. You should just take responsibility and you should plead guilty and quit whining. The cops wouldn't have charged you if you didn't do it.
Yeah. To say that to Paul Manafort.
Well, I don't know enough about his case, but certainly the government's put a lot of resources into bringing this prosecution, so they'll tell you that they've got a strong case.
It's pretty fascinating, that whole thing going down. I mean, there's gazillions. I mean, there's more money than you and I will ever see in 10 lifetimes that they're talking about that he has misappropriated, laundered, however you want to term it all. It's pretty fascinating.
Well, and then what's really tragic, in a sense, I don't know if a better word to use it, but if the allegations that got his bond revoked and put into custody are true, yes, which the judge found there was credible evidence that he had been tampering with witnesses and trying to intimidate, that is pretty damning. You don't need to You don't need to manipulate and interfere with the mm-hmm. process. If you're innocent, you don't need to intimidate a witness, do you?
Doesn't seem like it. But if you've got connections with the Russian mob and all that stuff, and you can say, hey, you know, maybe you don't want to testify, I'm going to get Vladimir over here to come rough up your family. I don't know what he said. I have no idea what was alleged. I just, yeah, well, like you said, well, that his bond was revoked because he was allegedly tampering witnesses.
Well, those are very serious allegations. They tell you anytime you're accused of a crime, don't have any contact with all these, and they list people you don't have a contact with, and don't do certain things. And he violated those conditions, and he's sitting in jail now, which really hampers his defense. Yes. It really does.
I wanted to ask you, I don't think we've ever talked about this on the podcast, but it did come up on Twitter last week from someone that posts a lot of criminal justice reform articles about him being in prison, and he's got his own phone line, and he's got a laptop, and so forth. He's got his own personal change of clothes and all this stuff. And I know that we talked about it offline, but can you tell me if that's okay?
Well, I don't know about the separate phone line. I know that provisions were made. He's pretrial and he's presumed innocent. And therefore, he needs to be provided access to his attorneys and he needs to be provided access to discovery. Well, it's been widely done in the federal system for a long number of years of them providing discovery electronically. So defendants in federal cases are routinely provided access to a computer so they can look at their discovery. I don't recollect anybody who I've assisted with a defense having their own cell phone or on their own private phone line. I haven't heard of that one before.
Yeah, he supposedly has. I don't think it's just one either. He has multiples, as far as I understand.
Well, if the federal judge ordered it, that's all it takes. The judge issued an order that he be. The judge is probably being very careful that there's no appearance that his defense is being hampered, because that would come up later in an appeal that he was not allowed access to his attorney. So they're probably making provisions for him to have more than what the run of the mill defendant would have. But a computer is not unheard of. That's routine in the federal system. I've seen that for years now.
The point that I'm trying to drive home is he is pre-trial, so he is presumed innocent, innocent until proven guilty, and he should have, not unrestricted, because he's obviously shown that he needs to have a little bit more supervision because of the alleged intimidation stuff. But that's why he is able to have these extra things going on.
Well, I agree. I've said that for years and years and years. I believe that our detention facilities ought to be designed to provide a greater access to the outside world for those who are merely being detained pre-trial. Because of our commercial bond system in this country, you may be innocent, but you don't have the $5,000 or the $10,000 or the $50,000, whatever the case may be. And therefore, you should be presumed innocent, and you should be allowed reasonable access to telephones, to computers, to conduct your day-to-day. Your business is going to collapse if you're right. In pretrial detention, and you get to use the phone for 10 minutes for a recorded phone call that goes off every 90 seconds saying, this call is coming from a correctional facility. Right. Be aware that this call is monitored. Can you imagine if you were trying to run your business, how well that would go over when you made your one call a day or whatever you got to try to run your business? So I believe that we should do the very thing that's being provided to Paul Manafort, that should be a part of our pretrial detention process, is that we should provide a much more access and a much less restrictive environment, because you are presumed innocent. You're there, but for you don't have the money to pay the bonds, the bondsman, or the restrictions or such that you can't meet. But usually it's a bond. It may be housing that you don't have, that the place that you, if you can't go back and be with the person that you were accused of victimizing, they may say, well, you can't go back there and you can't be within so many feet, but usually it's money that holds you in jail.
Right. Right. Well, then the article we have next is from the Marshall Project. And this is something we've been driving home for quite a while now, is more ex-prisoners can vote. They just don't know it. Do states have an obligation to educate formerly incarcerated people about their new rights? This one, so I think it's 12 states that are, you're just done. You're just banned from voting. But otherwise, that leaves 38 that are, to some degree, whether it's like we've talked about the New England states that you can vote even while you're locked up. But, and in Florida, where 1.7 million people are banned from voting because of criminal histories. That is a lot of folks. There's probably 30 million or so in Florida. I'm throwing a dart against a wall here just to see. It's somewhere in that ballpark. So that's a good chunk of people that can't vote.
It is indeed. And disenfranchisement is a serious issue, and it affects the outcome of elections. It really does. If you've got a million citizens in a state that can't vote, I mean, that would have to impact.
And going back to Florida, there's a ballot initiative coming up in November where they would give the voting rights back to formerly incarcerated person not convicted of murder or a major sex offense. And I guess we could speculate about what the major ones are without going and digging in what it is specifically. This obviously impacts, how many people nationwide do you think that is?
I don't even know. I've seen a number, but it's they say it's close to a third of the American public has been arrested, but I don't know what actually has a what the percentage is on a felony conviction.
The article, but I don't think it says.
It's millions.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, if it's 1.7 in Florida, I mean, if we just take that and extrapolate it out to 50 states, so that's 60 or something million people. Obviously, some states would have more or less, but that's a whole lot of folks. And I guess an episode or two ago, I mean, this almost, I called it gerrymandering, and it's not, it's just disenfranchisement, but it does seem like that you could construct laws, and this is totally Jim Crow, if you constructed laws that were designed to target roughly a particular segment of the community and to prevent them from voting, you would be able to sway elections. That is kind to me. That's what the idea of gerrymandering is to sway elections one way or the other by geography is what gerrymandering.
Well, one of the quotes in the article seems pretty clear that if you look under the, in Alabama, it looks like that 47 specific felonies out of 500 can be denied the right to vote. But the Alabama Secretary of State John H. Merrill, has done little to let prisoners know about the change, and he, and it's quote, I don't see any reason to contact them directly if we're already reaching the entire population, Merrill said in an interview. I don't care how many we've registered who used to be in the prison, or how many between age of 20, or how many are black or white. It does not matter. We don't specifically target any single group. Basically, we have one goal in Alabama, is to make sure every citizen's registered and has a photo ID. But he says that he's not going to do any outreach.
Yeah. So he doesn't want those people to vote. I mean, he obviously would be beating the drum and putting public service announcements on television.
Well, that's what I'm saying. You've got 500 felonies apparently in Alabama, according to this article from the Marshall Project. This is not us saying that. So you've got 47 that deny you the right to vote. So you got 10%. So that would be confusing. Mm-hmm. A person would have to know which felony. Mm-hmm. So the Secretary of State say, well, it's not my job to tell you if you're a felony. If you come in here and you present yourself and you register and you qualify, we'll put you on the rolls if you have ID. But it's not my job to make this information. No, don't tell me your problems.
Can't you be charged with something if you try and register to vote and you're barred from voting?
Well,
I think I've heard of that.
You can. I've heard of people being prosecuted a couple thousand cases in the last 15 years.
So you could be, let's just say they barred sex offenders from voting. You could walk into the voter registration office and you go to vote. You've now just violated the terms of your registration stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And that could say.
Well, according to the, I'm just going to read from the article. In general, Democrats, this is quote, tend to favor giving more ex-prisoners the ballot box, likely believing they're more apt to support Democratic candidates. Now, of course, in this advocacy, I don't see that. I see the overwhelming number of our people reporting supporting conservatives. Republicans tend, I'm quoting again, to oppose these efforts, but no studies have comprehensively tracked the voting preferences of people with felony records. I believe if they actually did that research, the Republicans wouldn't have such fear, because the people I encounter tend to be very conservative, and they tend to more likely than not to vote Republican. So I think that the Republicans have a fear that might be unfounded. They might actually win some elections if they register more felons.
could happen, at least based on your information.
Well, I'm just reading from the Marshall Project.
So no, I know, but you have your own. You've been doing this a long time, and you've talked to a lot of people.
I've had the hundreds of people I've talked to through the years, and our audience, as I've analyzed it, tends to be very conservative.
And we've posited about why that would be.
So, I'm surprised they even tolerate me, because I know that they pick up that I'm a progressive, and I call myself a liberal, except you're not supposed to use that word anymore. Our side says, don't call yourself a liberal. That's been a tainted word. So you're supposed to say progressive.
Well, the reason why is because you have something of value to them.
Come again?
You have something of value that they seek.
Oh, I just made the connection of what you were saying.
My head is not in the gutter. Get yours out of the gutter. Okay. I'm saying that you have knowledge. You understand the process and all that. That's why they put up with whatever political leanings you have that are in contrast to theirs.
Well, that might be it, because I know that I rarely connect with anybody who politically is anywhere near me. They all tend to be. And I said, well, you know, this was, let's be honest, all this stuff was fine until it happened to you. You were for all this till it happened to you. And then they get mad at me for reminding them that they were. I said, well, when they were touting these laws to be tough on crime, how did you vote? How did you vote in 2016? Mm-hmm. When the major candidate for president said, I'm going to be the law and order president, you voted for him anyway, didn't you? And mm-hmm. they sheepishly admit that they did. And I said, well, then you're surprised. You're surprised that they're seeking maximum penalties. You're surprised that they've terminated the halfway house contracts and made it difficult for people to get their halfway house time on the end of their federal sentences, which generally was about 6 months. And you're surprised at all this stuff? I mean, they told you that's what they were going to do. And you voted for them anyway.
Here's something interesting, though, in the article towards the end of it. It says a man who's from Citronella, Alabama, was incarcerated in 2000 on a probation violation for criminal mischief and possession of a controlled substance. We'll call that weed. After he got out, he said the state continued to block him from voting. I tried for years. When Barack Obama ran, I wanted to vote for the first black president, but I gave up. So, yep, I mean, like right there, I mean, potentially, I mean, there's a fairly significant African-American population in Alabama. I'm going to guess that it didn't go for Obama, being as a red state as it is. But it could have.
It did not, but it there's that fear of I can't explain their fear because it's unfounded, but they have the fear that if more people vote, that it's going to tip the election against them, and they're hanging on for power for dear life.
Well, they would be the ones with all the inside data on how people lean, so maybe they actually do know, you know, from their own research. It's just it feels to me, if I were in these positions, it would be in my interest to serve as many people as possible, and the country would be better having more people represented fairly and equally than to just carve out little niches and have an us versus them strategy.
Well, that's you, but that's not them.
I get that. That's probably why I'm not there.
So power's hard to give up.
Yeah, that's what they say.
Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact them by email, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can call or text a ransom message to 747-227-4477. Want to support Registry Matters on a monthly basis? Head to patreon.com/registrymatters. Not ready to become a patron? Give a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. Or tell your buddies at your treatment class about the podcast. We want to send out a big heartfelt support for those on the registry. Keep fighting. Without you, we can't succeed. You make it possible.
Well, you have an article that is this getting published in the Narsal Digest?
It has been published, yes.
It has been published. All right. And the title of the article...
We hopefully will put that online Monday, the edition of the Digest. There's all these technical things related to links and connections and stuff I don't understand. But I know the Digest has been put out, the newsletter is out, and it's waiting to be distributed by email notification to our members, and it should be out in the next 24 to 48 hours.
All right. And that's as we are recording this Saturday night. But the title of the article is Wisconsin Supreme Court holds that lifetime GPS monitoring is not punishment. I am trying really, really, really hard to figure out how Big Brother watching you for the rest of your life is not punitive.
I had that same struggle when I read the case, and I was very dismayed that it was even a unanimous opinion. That it was not punitive. I was shocked that you can strap something on someone's body, intrude on every move they make. And this was a person who wanted to withdraw his plea, D'Anthony Muldrow. He had pled guilty to a second degree sexual assault. And that would have put him with the zone of having that GPS monitoring for life after he got off regular probation. So here's the kicker. Everybody concedes they can put you on GPS monitoring while you're paying your debt to society, but this is an administrative program that follows. It's basically attached within the registration scheme of Wisconsin that you will be monitored by GPS for life. And I think North Carolina has some offenses. Arkansas, this is becoming more phenomenal of a phenomena where that they build into the registration scheme GPS monitoring for life. He was not told that when he did the plea. He learned he was going to have to be subject to that, so he wanted to withdraw the plea. And the court said, no, you would only get to withdraw the plea if we misrepresented something that was going to be a punishment. But the GPS monitoring we're not changing the amount of time you're getting. The penalty is staying the same, but you're going to have an administrative requirement to wear a GPS. Now, I didn't get any details about how much he's going to have to pay for it and all that kind of stuff. I suspect he's going to have to pay for it. But I don't know how you can attach something that's going to invade someone's privacy and watch every move they make, and it creates sores and blisters on their body for the rest of their life. Even when they get, we've got a person in New Mexico that unfortunately I've not been able to render much value to him working on his case. He's got all sorts of health limitations and is just one step above being incapacitated, and they've got one of those things strapped on him.
Well, we've talked about I'm not going to encourage anybody to go cross state lines, you know, without getting permission or reporting or anything like that. But just by putting your foot into the next state or county, depending on what your situation is, as you say, Larry, you don't start emitting radiation of like, bing, 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 here I am, here I am. Or if you've crossed the threshold of the amount of time that you're allowed to be somewhere, you don't just start giving off radiation. But if you've got a GPS strap to your leg, you do.
You actually would be giving off radiation. Absolutely.
Right. You would totally be giving off that signal that's saying where you are in real time, like right now. Forget like, hey, somebody stumbles upon you. Maybe you back your car into another person when you're somewhere where you shouldn't be. And how is this not punishment again?
Well, they said that using the intent effects test that's been around since 1963 in the case the U.S. Supreme Court decided Kennedy versus Mendoza-Martinez. They said since this is not part of his punishment, we have to look at the intent of the law and the effects of it. So they could not discern any intent to punish. They looked at the preamble of the legislation. They said, we don't see any sinister motivations to punish. So therefore, we'll look at the effects. And they said that looking at the effects, that the intrusion was so minimal that they just didn't see that the effects. I just don't know how you could get. Let me strap something on you that you have to have strapped to you for the rest of your life.
You have to worry about getting it charged. You have to worry about you could end up like, you know, if he doesn't have any travel restrictions. So he goes to downtown New York where they have 100-story skyscrapers and you lose GPS signal. Now it shows him off grid. Now he gets arrested for just existing.
They didn't get into that minutia because he's still in prison. Right. He's making this challenge. But so we don't know whether those kind of things would happen. But just the mere act that being intruded upon to tell you that you've paid your debt to society, you're now on a civil regulatory scheme. As a part of the civil regulatory scheme, we're going to strap this thing on you. And like I say, they didn't get into the cost. If they did, I didn't pick up on that when I read the opinion. I didn't see anything about the cost of this. But even without regard to cost, having a device attached to your body that's invading your movements and recording them, even if it's passive GPS, which means that they download it at the end of the day rather than being active, even if it's a passive monitor, that is still invading. I bet if we put a GPS on your car, Mr. Justice, and we did that and we followed you everywhere you went, you would find that to be somewhat invasive, wouldn't you? Well, that's not strapping one on your ankle.
But that's what the Supreme Court held when they were putting secret GPS on cars that, you know, of suspects that they were interested in tailing instead of putting someone in the car and watching someone, you know, 24-hour surveillance or whatever. They would just sling a GPS on your car. And the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, said that they can't do that.
So, but this is okay because it's a part of a regulatory scheme that's targeted these individuals who fall within the zone of this law, which is to be convicted of a certain offense in Wisconsin. It's not the entire registry. It's within the zone of that of those covered offenses. But I don't know how they came to the decision, but it's more disturbing that it was unanimous. I can't even pontificate that perhaps the liberals would have done different because of the 7 justices on the Supreme Court, you'd like to think at least 2 or 3 were liberal, and they came to the same conclusion. I can only pontificate this. The Supreme Court they're all elected in Wisconsin, and it could be that they are fearing public ramifications of their decision because I had a recollection of a recall effort, and I couldn't find him. Preparation to the show any evidence, but I vaguely remember that there was a recall effort in Wisconsin.
Oh, okay. I was going to say Judge Persky, whatever, 3 or 4 months ago in California. Now that's not a Supreme Court justice, but it's a judge.
Yeah, it was a Superior Court judge there. But I thought I remembered an effort to dump a Supreme Court justice or two in Wisconsin, but I didn't find it in a quick Google search. But even if there's no, if I'm incorrectly remembering it, the fact that that they're elected statewide. And the pendulum is not exactly swinging toward the liberal side these days would give you pause for thought, even if you were a liberal, because I know that you're not supposed to take that into consideration, but people actually do take into account their mortgage payment and their kids' college fund and paying their dental bills and buying groceries. I mean, oddly enough, they're human beings just like the rest of us, and they do calculate where their next meal's coming from.
But that goes against the thing that we just talked about a few minutes ago of the judiciary being an independent body. Now they're not an independent body.
Well, they would only be independent if they were like the Article 3 judges of the federal judiciary that are appointed for life and confirmed by the Senate, and they don't have to stand before the people. But in Wisconsin, they do have to present themselves to be elected.
I feel that that is not the best way to do it.
I feel your pain, Andy. I agree with you.
It seems like, you know, and we've talked about this, like at the federal level, you've got a bunch of short-term people every 2 years. You've got a group that's a, you know, kind of a well, you've got the guy that's or gal that's kind of, you know, that intermediate term of 4 years, and then the Senate kind of a little bit longer term. And then you've got the people that are like a bedrock, and they're going to hold the line for a very long period of time. That feels like a pretty good strategy to me of very short term. They can move quickly with the changes in society. Then you have something that's a little bit slower to move, and then a group that's like, nope, this stuff doesn't change, but every generation. And this Wisconsin situation seems like, you know, every election cycle you could have a radically different government and no consistency from week one to week two.
I'm not a big believer in elected judges, so you don't have to do a lot to convince me. But we have a lot of states that do it. Our state is a hybrid where we do an appointed system where they have to stand for one election after being appointed, and then they go into a retention cycle, where it takes a supermajority of 57% to be retained. So the question before the voter is not do you support candidate A over candidate B. It's should judge so and so be retained for another term? Yes or no.
Interesting. Well, that's really disturbing.
They have to go through one election cycle after being appointed. There is an opportunity for them, because we could not, when we were all straight election back in the 80s, and then there was a desire to depoliticize it, and we couldn't quite get to the finish line of making it. So we have this hybrid where that they are appointed by an independent nominating commission, then they are put on the court, and then they can be challenged in the next general election. And then after, if they survive that, then they go into a retention cycle.
Hmm. Well, that's really awesome, Larry. Thank you for writing the article, but not thank you to Wisconsin for affirming that decision. I don't really think that they're a good group of people.
I was disturbed when I read the decision. Huh. That's why I took the time to. We don't have a writer from Wisconsin, but I thought it was so horrible that I took the time to write a little bit about it and read the opinion. And I'm distressed, but it is that.
Well, all right. Are you ready to cover my big project of a topic for the night?
And what would that be?
It is kind of a hybrid, but I want to recircle back around. I think it was episode one about if the registry is constitutional or not. And I know what your answer is going to be. And yes, we can just cut the podcast right here. We're done. No, it's not constitutional. Done. End of story. But I've just been kind of formulating these ideas lately about what it actually means to be constitutional or not. And it got enhanced a little bit. You know, we've talked about housing issues or how people are supposed to support themselves and all that. And Paul Dubling at the conference, he said, you do not have a constitutional right to housing or food or life or anything like that. It is not in the Constitution. We could debate all day whether it's humane to have these things, but you do not have a constitutional right to these things. It got me thinking about the broader concept of this guy, Judge Kavanaugh, the nominee for the Supreme Court vacancy, is he would be in favor of the notion that the Consumer Protection Financial Board, if I have that right, is an unconstitutional government organization. And to take that, so you could have some payday lender that's going to charge you, I don't know, let's come up with a number and just say they're going to charge you 50% of your paycheck to give you a payday loan. That's terribly predatory practice, but it's not an unconstitutional act. Am I right so far?
Well, I don't know that he would interpret it that way, but he could, yes.
Right. Well, I mean, I've heard that would be one thing. I'm speculating on the particular individual, but so you could have Supreme Court justices that would argue back and forth whether it's constitutional or not. But still, the notion of whether predatory payday lending practices are constitutional or not.
Well, you have conflicting parts of the Constitution. There are those who believe that the General Welfare Clause gives you great latitude, because they didn't define what that meant. And however, whatever government wants to do if you couch it in the general welfare clause to promote the general welfare of the people, I would argue, as a liberal, that trying to protect vulnerable people is permissible within the general welfare clause. If I were trying to defend such a statute to a constitutional against a constitutional attack, I would bring that into my repertoire of things I would argue to try to save the statute. But if you were a true conservative, you would say, well, general welfare as we understood it back in those days, because we can't think about an evolving standard of decency. We can only think about what the founding fathers would have envisioned when those men drafted those words. They wouldn't have been thinking about a consumer protection, financial protection board, and that wouldn't be the general welfare they would have been thinking. They would have a much more limited definition of what the general welfare would be. They'd probably think the general welfare would be keep people from being attacked by the redcoats and keep the national security of the newly born nation as an independent. That's what they would probably think. But like I say, he could easily come to that. If he was a literalist and a textualist, there's probably no constitutional basis for having the consumer financial protection agency. All these things are subject to a constitutional attack.
And I got very sad in thinking that all of this stuff is, if it's not written in the Constitution, and it's not interpreted as something that was going on in the 1700s, then we are just screwed now for anything that's new, because we have things like automatic weapons. Well, they didn't consider that back then, so it's not unconstitutional, it would be unconstitutional to take away your guns because you have a right to own them, and it's not written that way that you could take them away from the people. There's no limit to what that means.
Well, but that's where they amazingly do a flip-flop, the conservatives do on that. Because if you were to say, okay, there's no evolving, we would think of the right to weapons to be interpreted consistent with what weapons they would have visualized at the time. Yeah. They would never have visualized the weapons we have today.
Right.
The people in the 1780s would not have visualized the weapons we have today being in private hands. So you could arguably, I could say, well, since you are a literal textualist, do you have the right to pack your firepower in and fire one shot in a weapon? That's what the framers would have visualized you had a right to do.
Right.
They didn't say you had the right to automatic weapons. Where is that in the damn Constitution?
Sure. Sure. And I mean, I'm kind of, it's still not a very thoroughly complete thought, but our people end up running around saying it's unconstitutional, and then they immediately follow it up with citing statistics as to why they support that decision. They're mostly probably supporting the decision that they have, the opinion that they have, because it's affecting them. But if you just run around and you spout stats saying, well, there's only a 5% recidivism rate, that doesn't win you anything in court. It might eventually, if you can get down to evidentiary hearings and so forth, but the actual framework of the registry in most states falls into a category of being not constitutional. And I wanted to dig into that again and get your insight as to why it is not constitutional and really why we shouldn't even be bringing up statistics as far as our arguments with people or with legislators about the registry.
Do you have an hour?
No, not at all.
Well, the statistics, the Supreme Court did not say, contrary to people who will insist they did not say because recidivism was high that it was okay to have registries. They said that the legislature in Alaska was concerned about recidivism, and that was a fact that was handed to them because the case was decided on summary judgment in Smith versus Doe. The parties agreed facts can be proven in trial, and they can be agreed to by stipulation of the parties. And the parties agreed that Alaska's defense would have been, had they gone to trial, that there was a frightening high rate of recidivism. That became a fact of the case. But the court said, even with that being a fact of the case, we're still going to look at the intent and the effects of the registry, of the requirements as they exist that are before us. They didn't look out 20 years because they're not allowed to do that. They could not sit there and say, well, they might put some additional requirements on it. They looked at what was required at that time, and they said, we don't see the disabilities or restraints. If you want to look at Smith versus Doe, most of what you're looking for is on page 100 of the opinion. But they said, we don't see any disabilities or restraint in terms of your travel, your work. This is similar to turning in a car registration. Therefore, it is not punitive. It's a little bit inconvenient, but we don't see that it imposes punishment. But people want to argue public policy in the courts, and that's not what the courts are set up for. Whether or not recidivism is high or not is not what the courts will make their decision on, whether it's constitutional. Recidivism is not a constitutional factor. It's whether it imposes any disabilities or restraint and debilitations and disadvantages or whatever the standard is in your particular state. If the registry is doing those things, it's subject to a vulnerable to a constitutional. If you're living in Vermont where you have to mail a form in, your constitutional challenge may lack you may not get much traction with your challenge there because it's a relatively benign registration requirement. But when you fall into the trap of arguing recidivism, you can never win that because any amount of recidivism, my 100 bullet analysis with 97 of them being blank, I guarantee you I would not get any volunteers who would go out 100 yards and let me fire that 100 bullets at them. And I tell them only three of them could hurt you. Mm-hmm. The other 97 won't do any damage at all. If you are willing to concede it's okay to trample the Constitution, which you do that when you start arguing recidivism, if you're okay with trampling the Constitution, then the question becomes, well, what is an acceptable amount of recidivism? Because you have to admit there is some recidivism. Mm-hmm. I don't think any listener out there will say that there's absolutely zero recidivism. If there were, I've not seen that report. If you are willing to agree that it's okay to trample the Constitution, then you lose because there's no amount of recidivism acceptable. If you're willing to go out with a losing argument and argue recidivism, that's okay with me. I choose not to. I don't even go there. I tell people when they say recidivism's high, I say that's nice. You still can't do it. You still can't trample the Constitution, even if recidivism is high. That's really fine. I'm sorry about that. But after they pay their debt, after they serve their time, we have to let them go and we have to wait for them to commit a new crime and then we have to lock them up again. That's just the way it works in America. I'm sorry, boys and girls. That's the way I end the conversation. When they ask me, if not this, then what? I say, would we do what we do with other offenders? When they pay their debt, we let them go back and live their life. And if they offend again, we prosecute again. That's what we do.
More time next time around, too.
Right. That's what we do. And that's my alternative plan for the registry. It's very simple. We do it just like we do other criminals. We lock them up again. Kind of complicated, isn't it?
Do you think if you took something like the condition in Oklahoma where you have to have your driver's license stamped, do you think if that were to have gone in the 2003 case in Alaska, do you think they would have found that to be unconstitutional?
Gee, that's a tough one because the branding, which it essentially is, you can mark a document. No one will say that you can't mark. I mean, we mark documents all the time. I give the example of driver's license for minors, driver's licenses for people that have motor vehicle requirements to have visual corrective lenses. We mark that. We mark restricted licenses that allow you to operate only a certain hour. I mean, we have all kinds of marking we do on your driver's license. So clearly we can mark a driver's license in and of itself. That would not be facial invalid to put a marking. But putting a marking on a driver's license that is so debilitating as what they're doing in Oklahoma, that would be a very compelling argument. But it wasn't very compelling to the Tenth Circuit because the case went there and the Tenth Circuit said we don't find it to be all that debilitating. So that's just one notch below the Supreme Court.
I mean, you could say that if you get pulled over for a traffic violation and you aren't wearing your glasses, the cop can look up what your restrictions are instead of having to have it on your driver's license. He could just look it up in their computer system and know what you're allowed or not allowed to be doing, whether you're a minor or you have some sort of curfew requirements. They could see all that in the computer. So it doesn't necessarily have to be marked.
Well, a lot of this stuff goes back to the days before we had terminals in the computers terminals, computers in the car. And they did have to radio in, and you had radio jammed up, mm-hmm. too many officers seeking information. Nowadays, it's far more likely that they're going to be able to pull that up on their computer. So it's less needing to be marked, but they'll still argue that they need that because the system's not perfect. We have dead spots. We can't get through on the computer, and they'll still argue it's a public safety thing.
But why does the corner, liquor store need, when he says, I need to see your ID, or the cashier at the grocery store, when you buy a six pack of beer, why do they have any reasonable reason to know that you're on the registry?
Well, that's my whole point about how debilitating it is. It's debilitating when you try to cash a check. If I think there's at least three people that have checking accounts still out there somewhere. But if you try to pass a check, oftentimes we use a credit card. Matthew, your ID, please.
Or if you're going to pick up a plane ticket, you're going to have to show ID. There's no reason that the stewardess needs to know.
If you go to vote in these conservative states, you have to have picture ID. They're big on that, particularly, like I say, in the conservative states, they want to make sure that you have a picture ID. So I would argue that it would dissuade a person from voting if you have to go present that at the polls.
Right.
Sexual offender. Got a sex offender here, boys and girls.
Sex offender on aisle three. Sex offender on aisle three. So what other, do you think residency restrictions, or I'm pretty sure you'll say presence restrictions, but your living restrictions, if those had gone to the Supreme Court in the 03 case, do you think they would have found? I'm trying to stack on these things little by little to see when it would have crossed the line.
If you look at the Kennedy-Mendoza case, those seven factors, I think you would say that restricting where people can live would be a disability or restraint.
It's got to be considered a disability if you can't just live wherever you can afford to live.
But that wasn't before the court then.
Right.
We've got people that get so bad at the court, they'll say, well, I don't see how they could say. They didn't say that. They weren't asked to opine about that because that wasn't a part of the Alaska scheme. So they didn't get. Of course, if you were to ask them the question today, I think that even the most conservative justice would say, if you can't live at a place that you can afford to live, if you can't be free to move around and engage in commerce and make contractual arrangements with whomever you choose, I think they would say that was probably a disability or restraint. I think we might get, if those conditions had been present in 03, we might would have got a different decision, but they weren't.
Yeah, no, I get what you're saying. I mean, I'm trying to time shift and stack on things at different places and intervals, but you know, there's some point in time where you could stack on enough stuff to make it where it would tip the scale and say,
well,
yes.
They did. And Doze versus Snyder in Michigan, the Michigan legislature kept stacking and stacking. And a conservative panel of the Sixth Circuit said, you've stacked too much. So you can't actually cross the line.
And then why I kind of know the answer, but why can't that just then blanket, you know, filter out to the United States? Why don't then all of the cases and all the circuits start bubbling up where they've done similar things?
Well, because there's circuits who are not finding that. There are circuits where a case went from Louisville, Texas to the Fifth Circuit, where they effectively banished everybody from Louisville. About 99.6% of the parcels were off limits. And they said, that's not banishment. The Fifth Circuit said, we don't see this as a significant disability. It depends on the court. The United States Supreme Court has yet to weigh in on this stuff. They declined to review the Michigan case. They did not want to take a look at that time. They may see enough of a split forming around the country. They may decide to take a case at some point.
That's what I was just about to ask you. Isn't that one of the things that almost assuredly gets you a Supreme Court hearing, is when you have different circuits ruling differently?
That absolutely will cause them to say, we need to figure out what the law of the land is. And we might get a case where the Supreme Court finally erects boundaries of how far registries can go, but they won't stop registries. They will only tell you what you can't do. And people are waiting for the magic bullet from the court to say you can't register people. They can't do that because registries in and of themselves are not unconstitutional unless they're punitive. It's possible I could design you a constitutional registry if I wanted to.
Yeah.
I could tell you when to be easy to do. I could say, congratulations, Andy, you're a registered sex offender. We're going to take your picture the day you're convicted, and we're going to put that on the internet, and we're going to put the offense you're convicted of, and you go and have a great life. That would be a constitutional registry because your record of your crime is public, your mugshot is public, and we're not putting any disability or restraint on you. You can live where you want to. You can work where you want to. You can marry who you want to. You can do anything you want to, but you're a registered sex offender. That's an easy one. It would pass any constitutional any challenge that was ever asserted against it.
But you also then didn't throw in where you go get it updated every year.
Nope. You wouldn't have, there'd be no such requirement.
Yes.
that would be a constitutional registry.
So you immediately, after prison, you grow a beard and a mustache and you put on dark sunglasses all the time and no one knows who you are and they don't know where you live.
And then the question would become, how much more could we require before we would be imposing disabilities or restraint? Could we tell you to mail in a form to keep your address current? Probably. That would probably not be a disability or restraint. Could we tell you to come in every 3 years to have a picture made so that we have a semi-current? That's not too disabled. You do that every few years for your driver's license. That's not a restraint. So we could probably get away with getting you to update your picture.
You could probably even just tie it into the DMV records.
I think that would be an ideal thing, that would be your constant update would be as often as you update your driver's license, your photograph would constantly update your registry, and you'd still be able to go have a great life. And you wouldn't have to report to anybody. Your address would be updated when you update your driver's license. And most states have a requirement you update your driver's license. Now, there's not severe penalties for not doing it.
I was just going to say that. I mean, I moved a couple of years ago, and 30 days or maybe 90 days at the most before you have to, probably it's just, a $50 citation or something like that.
Yeah, it's a relatively modest penalty for not updating it. Nobody does.
And you don't go back to prison for doing it.
Nope, you don't.
Does that introduce some of the elements of the unconstitutionality of it, of what is the punishment for it, or does that not enter into the equation?
I think it's a peripheral issue in terms of the severity of the punishment. Regulatory schemes have penalties if you don't comply. I mean, just having a penalty doesn't make it non-regulatory. I mean, what kind of regulatory scheme would there be if there was no penalty? Who would comply?
Yeah, sure. It has no teeth. But I mean, if the penalty for not updating your driver's license because you moved addresses, if it's something, $25, $50, something really, really insignificant. But if you don't do the thing for the registry within 3 days, you get a 1 year minimum sentence or a 5 year sentence. So I'm wondering, I'm trying to balance those two. Fine, you could make it that you have to have your information updated and current. But the penalty is also benign.
I think it's a peripheral issue that could be argued that shows the punitive intent of the registry because they put such horrendous. I think you could make that an argument. Absolutely.
It sounds like it exactly is that.
Yeah, I think we had a story tonight that we didn't have time to get to.
We did not. It was in Pennsylvania. It was a Pennsylvania story where they're just totally, they're almost like intentionally sabotaging you to fail you to register.
Let's carry that over for next, because that one was phenomenal, that more people were getting registry violations than people were committing sex offenses.
Right.
So,
all right. Then to close this out, Lenore Skenazy, she posted on Twitter from an article that was out there. But so it says, Megan's Law gave us the public sex offender registry, but research shows it isn't making kids safer. In fact, most crimes against kids are by people not on the registry, and most registrants don't reoffend. And there was a flood of responses, and I wanted to throw some of these at you. I see some of the late night talk show people bring some of these kind of things into their shows, and so I wanted to get your candid response to some of the things that people wrote in response to Lenore. Oh, so crazy writes, so just because they don't do it again, doesn't mean that the list should just go away. That makes no sense.
So far, so good.
Oh, you're with that one?
I understand that's a common response.
Right. Well,
the reason why she's responding that way is most people are totally disconnected from the fact that the registry is not part of the person's punishment. They think that was a part of the penalty scheme. And for a person to say that tells me that person has no idea that it's a civil regulatory scheme completely disconnected from the person's punishment. If you were to ask that same person, or at least a group of people who you ask that question. So let me get this straight. After a person has paid their debt to society in full, and when I say that, I mean that they've paid any prison time, any probation, any supervision time, when they've done all that, do you think they should still be shamed and humiliated, have conditions imposed on them? Most of those people would say no. He or she doesn't realize that that's not a part of their punishment.
Why does that matter?
Because it would be okay for you to do something as a part of a person's punishment scheme. You have more latitude in what you can inflict on a person as part of their punishment. You conceivably could put registration as a part of their sentence. For the period of time that you're serving your punishment, you will be on a registry.
Doesn't that lead, I guess it's begging the question. if it is a civil regulatory scheme, however, the common assertion by people would be that it is just part of your punishment. Doesn't that contradict each other?
Yes, yes, it does. But I'm saying, you asked me about it. If you were to tell people as a part of your punishment, you will get 5 years probation and you will register for those 5 years.
Right.
That would probably pass constitutional muster.
Yes.
Because you're allowed to do things when you're punishing people that you're not allowed to do when you're not punishing people. You have a little bit more latitude in right. terms of what you could do. And well, the average citizen thinks the registry is a part of your punishment. They don't understand that it's a collateral consequence that lasts way and lingers way beyond your punishment. So I understand. I'm okay with that because that's the average person's perception. They don't know the registry is totally separate. They think it's a part of the sentence.
I'm with you, but that I still feel that actually might, to me, it feels like it's a chink in the armor that we could plug away at, that it goes to support the notion that the misnotion that the registry is just a civil regulatory scheme, but people believe it's part of the punishment. If people consider it to be part of the punishment, it probably is part of the punishment.
We could probably make that as an argument that we could build up in the next declaratory action. We could go out and have the funding to interview 300 people. Yeah. And I think we'd get 292 of them and say, hell yes, it's a part of their punishment. And they deserve it.
Right. And yeah, that sounds kind of interesting as a way to push that back on the system. All right. Then D Yella with a bunch of underscores in there says, absolutely effing not. When I was a teen girl in my old neighborhood, when I was a teen, a girl in my old neighborhood was sexually assaulted by some dude while she was walking back from school. The registry allowed the cops to narrow down potential suspects in the area, eventually leading to the capture of a guy with a record.
And?
Well, somebody I saw wrote and said, what does that have to do with it being public? If the police had access to it, make it law enforcement only, then the public doesn't even know.
That was what I was about to say. That was what one of the original premises was of the registry to start with, is that it precious investigative hours and moments were lost because the cops needed to zero in on who had those proclivities. So therefore, that this would save time. Well, if that's the case, then why do you need it to go outside the law enforcement community? Why do you need it to be open to the public? Well, of course, that's BS. But that's if that's truly his, then we should try to recruit him to say, okay, we agree with you. Let's make the registry law enforcement. Or will you join us in that effort? Right. See what he says.
Sure. All right. Erica John said, is it not considered that the people on the registry don't reoffend because they're on the registry and have to identify themselves? So she's arguing for the deterrence element of it.
Well, I unfortunately, to my own regret, I sometimes make that statement myself, and it's only because I'm trying to get people to understand the other side.
Yeah.
I don't believe in the registry. I don't support the registry. I fight against the registry, so you don't need to send an email for me to get my head straightened out. But it is possible that people, by utilizing the information that otherwise would have been hidden, it is possible that offenses didn't happen because they were able to take precautions to keep their relative or their neighbor away from a neighbor. It is possible. You cannot win that argument because you can't prove what didn't happen. You can't prove that. Therefore, I tell it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if it saved 1, 20, 47, however many it saved. We can't do this because it's not constitutional.
And tell me why again.
Because it imposes disabilities or restraints. It keeps these people from having housing. It restricts where they can live, where they can work, their travel,
education,
their interactions. It imposes too many restraints. You can't do that in a regulatory scheme.
In a punitive scheme, but this can't be a punitive scheme because it's been it is being bolted on after the original conviction.
I make the offer that I will even take the pot shots from our people if it saves one. If that is your standard, I will trade you the constitutional rights of the people I advocate for if you'll do the same on the Second Amendment. Because I can assure you the fewer weapons we have on the street, there will be fewer people dying. I can't assure you that there'll be no people dying, but all you want to do is save one. That's the standard. We can save at least one, because if you have the rapid fire weapons less accessible, they may be able to kill people with weapons, but they wouldn't be able to kill as large a number. So the Vegas shooter might have been able to shoot 7 versus 59 or whatever it was he shot.
He shot over 600 people.
But didn't like 50 something die?
Yes.
Yeah, like in the Pulse nightclub, it's like 40 something. So if your standard is to save one, I will flush my constitutional rights down the crapper if you will do the same. I will join you in that effort, and I don't get any takers every time I make the offer.
Because damn it, we have a right to own guns.
But you would logically want to save one, wouldn't you?
I think be consistent.
Yes, that's what you just said.
But you would then be able to apply that if you want to save one by, and then you just be able to just bolt on everything. But we shouldn't be able to eat fast food.
But we're talking about constitutional rights.
I know.
I believe that the Constitution is absolutely clear that you have the right against ex post facto punishment. The Constitution is also clear you have the right to own weapons. Now, it doesn't specify what weapons you have the right to own, but I am a firm believer that the Constitution gives the individual right to own firearms.
Yeah. It says bear arms and form militias and all that stuff. There's some extra stuff in there.
I believe that. But if you're willing, I'm just saying on a constitutional basis, I will take the ex post facto clause and I will flush it if you'll flush the Second Amendment. I've got that deal on the table. And I'll let my people argue with me and tell me what a creep I am if you'll go back and tell your people, in order to save one, we have to do something to save one. And if you'll do it, I'll do it.
And then FSM McDaniel tweeted, I totally disagree. Maybe time limits on the registry determine on a case-by-case basis, but the registry is doing more good for the safety of children and women than you know.
Well, maybe it isn't. I don't believe it is. It hasn't been proven to me, but I don't give a damn. We can't punish people with a regulatory scheme, regardless of whether it's doing good or not. Sorry, boys and girls, it doesn't stand. You can't do it. So I don't have to go all that all those details. It may be doing good. It may not be doing. I'm not convinced it is, but it doesn't matter to me if it is or isn't.
Yeah, and my whole argument, my whole reason for bringing these things in there is I'm trying to introduce to our listeners to evolve past the idea of just trying to introduce to our listeners who spout all the statistics saying the recidivism rate and so forth, when actually what we really need to be going after is a constitutional argument. I suppose you could bring in the, even Paul Dooling said you can introduce the statistics. You know, you get into the legislator and you're saying, hey, here it is. This is unconstitutional. Also, it's good policy because it wastes all this money, XYZ.
I'm okay with that. And it's particularly if they confront you with statistics, you need to rebut them and say, well, actually, that's wrong. But regardless, even if it were true, you can't do it. I'm sorry. I always have to get back to your point is you can't do it because it's unconstitutional. You can't punish people with a regulatory scheme. And that's where you have to always focus the conversation back on. Do you believe that you should be able to put punitive conditions on people after they paid the debt to society? And if you ask a true conservative, if they truly are conservative, they would say no. And then you say, okay, well, then why are we doing that?
It's for the safety of one.
Okay, well, then let's go to the Second Amendment because we can save at least one more.
I understand.
I only need to save one by your, and I'm buying into your philosophy. You say if it saves one, it's worth it to trample the Constitution. I'm getting on this train with you.
Right.
But you're going to have to help me save one by doing something where you have to tell your people that you think it's okay to trample the Constitution. And if you'll do it, I'll do it. I don't expect I'll ever have to do that because I don't think I'm going to get any takers from the conservative side wanting to trample the Second Amendment.
No, and I would encourage anyone who agrees or disagrees, write into us, and you'll have all the links, you know, here in a second. But tell me where we're wrong on this. But it's taken me talking to you for like a year specifically for the podcast, but longer than that. You've told me this 100 times by now or 50 times by now, and it's still just starting to slowly sink in. And then I'm outside walking or whatever, and I go, oh, that's what he was talking about. And it takes a while for it to sink in. I'm kind of thick.
Well, I'm thick too, so it takes a while for it to sink in. And I try to keep it simple because I'm a simple-minded person.
No doubt.
And you keep it simple, then you can understand it.
Well, I don't have anything else. That's all I got.
Well, I'm glad to be with you. And how would people contact us if they do have these comments?
Absolutely. Go to the website, and I'm working on a huge, huge update to the website. I can't tell you when it'll be done, but I'm doing a lot of work on it. But that it's over at registrymatters.co. Search inside your podcast app for Registry Matters, and you'll get these things as soon as they're released. If you want them even sooner, support us over at patreon.com/registrymatters. Phone in and send a text message or leave a voicemail message at 747-227-4477. And lastly, but not leastly, registrymatterscast@gmail.com.
That is a lot of sevens. Did you deliberately plan that number?
When I was looking it up, it resonated because it was a lot of sevens. Yes. I just, I had Google kind of, make suggestions, but then when I scrolled past that one, I was like, yep, that'll work.
Well, it's a great number.
I like it. That's all I got, Larry. It's Saturday night. Go out and party.
I'm going to do that. I'm going to go and party on the town.
Excellent. I'll talk to you soon. Thanks again.
Good night.
Bye.